Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on story time. Tell them a story right after this. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor. And we've been taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if your plumber said, he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? Or what if your carpenter said, he who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client? Now, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or steps is incompetent? Well, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who couldn't represent himself has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or that carpenter. Well, listen to James Nielsen. Now, he's a professor at the Hastings Law School. Here's what he had to say. He said it's a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. And he said it's worse than that. Most students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. And a student can graduate without having set a foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person who is in need of advice or counsel. And a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and their clients, that it is a cruel hoax. Now, that's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package while you're at it. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free. Now, our school, Courtroom Strategy and Procedure, is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Again, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email, or better yet, click on to our archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. That's georgegordon.org, and go to our archives page. All right, last time we were talking about the OSHA EPA codes and knowing about the law, knowing what to expect, and then knowing how to defend against it. Years ago, I used to have a student who had a case in front of a traffic court judge or if it was some low-level magistrate. It was probably, a magistrate's court, something like Judge Judy or something on that order. But oftentimes a student, or in this case a defendant, can be tricked. They can be blindsided. Even in these lower courts, if a prosecutor comes in and makes a motion, let's say, to have the defendant committed to the state psychiatric hospital for observation, he can oftentimes accomplish something that's miraculous from the point of view of the prosecuting attorney. For instance, let's suppose that the prosecutor hasn't been able to convict you or hasn't been able to stop you from whatever it is you're doing or he thinks you ought not to be doing. and he needs to get even with you. He really wants to burn you. Well, if he were to move the court, suggesting that you're mentally unbalanced or unstable and unable to stand trial, he could have you committed for up to 90 days for psychiatric evaluation, which is about the equivalent of a 90-day sentence. And you haven't even been brought to trial. Now, many people would say, well, I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not sure that I'd know what to do, so I think I better hire a lawyer. Well, this young fellow went in pro se, and he beat the prosecutor. So before we get into Tim's story, let me tell you a story about lawyers. Now, we're about to read the names of 12 of our nation's most prominent lawyers. Now, one of these 12 men was a law school dropout. These are pretty famous people. I think you'll recognize a lot of these names. And our job is to see if we can guess which one of these 12 American presidents, Supreme Court justices, and very prominent men in the field of law was a law school dropout. The first one was Patrick Henry. Patrick Henry passed his oral bar examinations in 1760, and within 3 years he had handled more than 1,100 cases. He was a member of the Continental Congress and later governor of Virginia. Was it Patrick Henry that dropped out of law school? John Jay was admitted to the bar in 1768, and subsequently he distinguished himself as the first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. John Jay, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Surely he could not have been a law school dropout. John Marshall passed his bar exam in 1780. He later became a Supreme Court Chief Justice. He was the second Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. Do you think that a Chief Justice would be a law school dropout? William Wirt was barely 20 when he practiced law in Culpeper County, Virginia, and he eventually became United States Attorney General. An AG, law school dropout. Roger Taney was admitted to practice in 1799. He served as first Secretary of the Treasury, then as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Daniel Webster was admitted to the Boston Bar in 1805. He established a phenomenal legal reputation, and he also served as Secretary of State in 1841. Salmon P. Chase gained his early prominence as a defense attorney for runaway slaves, and also later became Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Abraham Lincoln gained his experience as a lawyer and became the 16th President of the United States. Abraham Lincoln, remember, was an attorney. Do you think Abraham Lincoln was that law school dropout? Stephen Douglas was admitted to the bar in 1834. He later became a representative, then senator, from Illinois. He's best remembered for his Lincoln-Douglas debates with Abraham Lincoln. Clarence Darrow was a lawyer of world renown, whose most famous case was the Scopes Monkey Trial. It was the so-called Monkey Trial of 1925. Robert Story was born in 1893. He served as president of the American Bar Association in 1952 and 1953. Strom Thurmond was admitted to the bar in 1930. He later became governor of South Carolina, then senator from that state. Now remember, one of these distinguished gentlemen is a law school dropout. He abandoned law school after the first year, never to return. Now, the reason that I bring this story to your attention is because oftentimes people will say to me, you can't beat City Hall. You have to have a lawyer. I'm not really sure that that's necessarily the case, as we'll see when we listen to the answer to which one of these prominent American jurists was a law school dropout? Was it Patrick Henry, John Jay, John Marshall, William Wirt, Roger Taney, Daniel Webster, Salmon P. Chase, Abraham Lincoln, Stephen Douglas, Clarence Darrow, Robert Story, Strom Thurmond? Who do you think? All right, if you've got your pick made, it was Clarence Darrow. Clarence Darrow was the law school dropout. Clarence Darrow, the one name that the whole world associates with the practice of law, attended law school for only 1 year. He never distinguished himself, and he dropped out to study law on his own. Now, for the other 11 distinguished American jurists, we should remember, in concluding, that it should be stated that the other 11 distinguished American lawyers could not have dropped out of law school because they never went to law school in the first place. Now, I want you to think about that. Patrick Henry, John Jay, John Marshall, Roger Taney, Daniel Webster, William Wirt, Salmon P. Chase. Now, let me cover these four. John Jay, John Marshall, Roger Taney, and Salmon P. Chase are four chief justices of the United States Supreme Court who never spent a day in law school. Patrick Henry, William Wirt, Abraham Lincoln, Stephen Douglas, Clarence Darrow, Robert Story, and Strom Thurmond are all very distinguished names in law, and none of them graduated from law school. And the only one that ever spent any time in law school was Clarence Darrow. He only spent a year there. Now, what this demonstrates to us as we've been discussing this thing of stories is that it tells us a very important story, like the story of the goose that lays the golden egg. It has a moral to the story, a moral that we learn from and we remember, as opposed to memorization. Remember, memorization goes hand in hand with indoctrination. The modality that we deal with today in our educational institutions is indoctrination through memorization. Now, what we're trying to achieve here is education. Education is a different animal than memorization. All of these men achieved a level of education that prompted or promoted them into powerful positions in the law. One of them, President of the United States. They were all practicing attorneys, all admitted to the bar, and yet none of them graduated from law school. Now, that's very important as we get back to my student. He called me one day at Barrister's Inn, and he said, "I have gotten word that the prosecuting attorney is intending to move to have me committed for psychiatric evaluation and committed for 90 days to the Napa State Hospital." And he said, "What can I do to prevent that?" Well, let me ask you, what would you do if you received a telephone call from an anonymous secretary in the courthouse? The prosecutor is intending. He's going to do something that's really tacky. He's going to come into court and he's going to move with a petition to have you committed for 90 days for psychiatric evaluation. He has been unable to convict you. He's been unable to do anything with you. And so he's going to punish you. He's going to create a methodology of punishment by using the law to punish you. And you haven't done anything worthy of 90 days in jail. And yet you're liable to be spending 90 days in jail unless you can work out or think up or come up with some defense. All right, well, here's the defense to this kind of a move. In fact, I recommend to all of my students that they do this in advance so that they're always prepared for this kind of underhanded, tricky prosecutorial move. Now, listen up and let's learn a lesson. I said, in order to have you committed, then he must show that you're mentally unstable, or that we don't know about your mental stability, and that we need to investigate it to find out if you're mentally unstable. So our job then is to show that you are, in fact, mentally stable, competent to stand trial, competent to move forward, competent to manage your own case. How do we do that? It's very simple. We simply walk into any psychiatrist who is listed in the Yellow Pages, and we say, I need a psychiatric evaluation. Costs $150. For $150, the psychiatrist or the psychologist will give you a battery of tests, takes about 3 hours, and he will determine whether or not you are mentally competent to move forward. So Tim did that. He went in, I believe it was on a Thursday. Now he's going into trial, going into the hearing. It's really not a trial. It's going into a hearing next Tuesday. So this week, on Thursday, he makes an appointment, goes into the psychiatrist in, Vallejo, California. And he takes the battery of tests, and when he walks out, he passes, and he has a piece of paper now from a state-licensed psychiatrist that says that this fellow, Tim, is, in fact, mentally competent. And then he has no psychoses, and he's in good mental health. Now, on Tuesday morning, he walks into the courtroom with his attaché case and with his little piece of paper in his bag, and sure enough, as the proceedings move forward, the prosecuting attorney brings up the subject of competence and capacity to move forward, and he moves to have Tim committed to the Napa State Hospital for 90 days for psychiatric evaluation to determine whether or not he's competent to move forward to trial. Now, in our system of Anglo-Saxon administration, and for you people that live in places like Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, and in Europe, and Brazil, and so place, and so forth, you will have, because of Anglo-Saxon administration, because the British occupied your real estate at one time and put the common law, that is, the common law, into operation in your countries. This is probably the state of affairs yet in Pakistan and India and Kashmir and, you know, all over the world, Africa, African countries. Now, some of them may have repealed these British laws, but by and large, I'll bet you that you'll find it there. It's called Notice and Opportunity to Defend. The defendant has to have notice and opportunity to defend. Furthermore, he has to have available to him witnesses for his defense. So Tim is then addressed by the judge and says, you know, the judge says to him, do you have anything to say concerning this motion? Tim jumps up. He says, yes, Your Honor, I do. I'm prepared to offer witnesses, evidence, and testimony today that I am, in fact, competent, and that I am prepared to move forward at trial, and that I am competent to handle my own defense, and that I am sane. And the judge said, well, what evidence do you have? And he said, well, first of all, I would like to call witnesses to testify, but I have a letter from my psychologist. And last Thursday, I took a test, and I have been certified sane and competent as of last Thursday. And the judge said, well, let me see that evidence. So Tim showed the judge the evidence, and the judge took a minute, and he read it. And he said, now show this to the prosecutor. And the prosecutor took it, and the prosecutor read it. And the prosecutor said, well, based upon this letter from Mr. So-and-so's psychiatrist, in this case it was a psychologist, he said, I will withdraw my motion. And Tim said, I object. I object to the withdrawal of this motion. Can you believe this? Yep, that's what he did. He said, I object. And the judge said, why are you objecting to the prosecutor's withdrawal of his motion to commit you for psychiatric evaluation? And so Tim said, well, because I'm entitled to equal protection and due process of law. And because of the Equal Protection Due Process Clause, I demand that the prosecutor be committed for psychiatric evaluation to determine whether he's competent to move forward. I've met my burden of proof. He hasn't. This is his motion. He's raised it. If I can meet the burden of proof that he has demanded, equal protection demands that he meet that same standard. The judge said the prosecution's motion is denied, and the original motion is denied, and his motion to withdraw is granted. Now we will move forward. Now there's a clear-cut example of a victory on the part of a lowly pro se defendant against a very skilled, and I'm presuming that this very skilled prosecuting attorney has been to law school. Most of them are, you know. Now again, this story is real life. This is the way the real world works. I have seen students who did not know how to defend, who were not prepared. I've seen them sent off to the psychiatric ward for 90 days, and they come back. And so far, they've all come back with a vote from the psychiatric hospital that they are competent and they are sane. But it took 90 days. Now, you're going to be gone for 90 days. It's the equivalent of being jailed for 90 days while this process takes place. And this doesn't have anything to do with your sentence. You know, that's kind of the tragedy of it all. All right, now here's something that's very simple that everybody can do, and it doesn't take very much. I carry one with me all the time. About every 5 years, I go into a psychiatrist or psychologist and say, hey, listen, I need a certification to determine whether I'm competent. And I spend the $150 and I walk out and I've got a letter in my pocket and it says, yeah, this guy's competent. You need one about every 5 or 10 years. I mean, you don't have to go in there every year to prove that you're sane. You know, about every 5 years, hey, I've been certified sane. How about you, partner? So in case somebody brings that up, you're prepared for it. That's the moral to the story. Let me tell you another little story over here that's kind of cute. It has to do with God and the EPA. God and the EPA. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. God was then faced with a class action lawsuit for failing to file an environmental impact statement with the EPA, that is, the Environmental Protection Agency, an angelically staffed agency dedicated to keeping the universe pollution-free. God was granted a temporary permit for the heavenly portion of the project, but was issued a cease and desist order on the earthly part, pending further investigation by the HEPA. Upon completion of his construction permit application and environmental statement, God appeared before the HEPA Council to answer questions. When he was asked why he began these projects in the first place, he simply replied that he likes to be creative. After all, I am a creator. This was not considered adequate reasoning, and he should be required to substantiate this claim further. The HEPA was unable to see any practical use for Earth, since the Earth was void and empty and darkness was upon the face of the deep. Then God said, "Let there be light." He never should have brought up this point, since one member of the council was active in the Sierra Angel Club and immediately protested, asking, "How is the light to be made? Would there be a strip mine mining permit issued? What about thermal pollution, air pollution?" And God explained that the light would come from a great ball of fire. Nobody on the council really understood this, but it was provisionally accepted, assuming, first of all, that there would be no smoke or smog from this ball of fire, and that, two, a separate burning permit should be required, and three, since continuous light would be a waste of energy, it should be dark at least one half of the time. So God agreed to divide light and darkness, and he would call the light day and the darkness night. When God was asked how the earth would be covered, God said, "Let there be a firmament amidst the waters." And the council tabled the action, since God would be required to seek a permit from the ABLM, that's the Angelic Bureau of Land Management, plus water permits from other agencies. It appeared everything was in order until God said that he wanted to complete the project in 6 days. The HEPA said this was completely out of the question and totally unreasonable. They said that they needed a minimum of 180 days to review the environmental impact statement plus public hearings, and that it would take 10 to 12 months before any permits could be granted. So God said, "To hell with it." Now, when we read a little story like that, which is kind of humorous, we ask ourselves, well, what about these governmental agencies, and what about the laws, rules, and regulations, and permits, and permitting that comes from these agencies that seem to be so frustrating to so many people? And I would submit that God would probably be pretty put out if he had to go to a governmental body to get permission to create the earth and the universe. I mean, think about it. We can't create or produce. We're totally stymied here. Each and every one of these stories that deal with legal questions tells us a little bit more about the legal process. And if we're not brain dead from memorization and we still have any functioning mind left, and we can use our minds to read and study law to see answers to these kinds of questions, and what is it that I could do in the event, or what could I learn, and how can I use that in the event that this comes about, or I need to go defend, or I need to justify what it is that I'm doing? How do I do that? Well, there's an issue in law which deals with money and monetary policy and money and the monetary system. Now, there's two stories here that I want to tell you. I'm going to show you, first of all, the history of the first issue of bills of public credit, which deals with inflation in the American colonies, which was brought about by government interference into the monetary system. In the same way that we see here, governmental intervention or interference in the creative process. After all, you want to build a house and you've got to have a building permit. You've got to pay money in taxes. And pretty soon, a lot of times, people who are in the business world just say, "To hell with it. I won't even do it." I'm one of those. I used to run a business that employed 30 people, and one day I woke up and I said, "To hell with it, I'm not going to do this." I closed the company. And I am very pleased to report to you today that today I employ no one, produce nothing, and pay very little tax. Now, at one time, I employed 30 people, paid $200,000 a year tax, and I produced about $1.2 million a year worth of product for the economy. I thought I was one of Tricky Dick's silent majority, and I was very pleased as an American to contribute my portion to the national economy. I thought that while I'm not a Bill Gates, I am employing some people. They are making reasonable product, and we're making at least that much contribution to the national economy, and we're paying taxes. Not only was I paying, you know, a bundle of taxes, but all of my employees are contributing their payroll taxes. All right, so we'll take our break here, and then we'll be back, and we'll take a look at this thing of the history of the first issue of bills of public credit called inflation in the American colonies between 1690 and 1756. Again, tell them a story. Now, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's eight schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about this thing of can you go into court and can you argue a position? Do you know what the law is as it relates to the issue that's being brought up or that you're being charged with or that you want to present or defend? Now, in monetary policy, I personally use gold and silver coin as the basis of our family business. We practice private business, and as a result of that, we use American, U.S. gold coin. And we don't have connecting links such as business licenses and attachments. We don't have citizenship, and we don't pay income tax. Now, that really touches people, especially prosecuting attorneys, IRS agents, and other government agents. They believe in the fair market value rule. Everybody has to pay his fair share. Now, I don't make these laws. What I wanted to do was to point out to you that laws exist and they need to be researched so that you know what your position is. If you don't, you can be convicted for crimes that don't even exist. You can be prosecuted and convicted for doing something that's perfectly legal simply because of your ignorance. Now, in the example that I gave you with Tim, you could be prosecuted and confined, not in jail, but confined in a mental institution, just on the motion of a prosecuting attorney who says, hey, I think this guy's nuts. I don't know if he's nuts, but let's go find out. And the judge, if you can't defend against it, the judge will say, well, there's a motion before the court to confine you for psychiatric evaluation, and you can't answer. So therefore, there's a question in everybody's mind, are you or are you not crazy? So therefore, let's commit you for 90 days and find out. 90 days later, come back and say, no, he's not crazy, he's perfectly sane. Oh, whew, thank God. We were concerned, sir, that maybe you were nuts, but now we're happy that you're not. That's 90 days after your confinement. It's a tricky move. It's unethical. It's not illegal. It's just unethical. It's a slap in the face. It's the kind of thing that people ought not to engage in, but you know, that's the way life is. Prosecutors get their emotions up and they say, hey, I'm going to punish this guy because I don't like him. Now, we should take a look then at the law to see whether or not what it is that we're doing has any legal merit. So I've got a couple of stories that I want to tell you over this program and the next, and let's see if we can learn a lesson here about the monetary system of the United States. Now, in the Bible, God gives us some specific laws. One of these laws is thou shalt not steal. And we're going to take a look here at a theft practice that's carried out by government to this day, that's prohibited in the scripture, that everybody participates in. Well, nearly everybody participates in. And the government says, if you participate in this criminal activity with us, you're okay, and we won't prosecute you. But if you don't participate in this criminal activity with us, we're going to prosecute you and put you in jail. So what they're in effect saying is, if you obey God and keep his commandments, we're going to throw you in jail. Now, in looking in the Bible, you find that that's exactly what these people have been doing for thousands of years. You know, just take Daniel in the lion's den. They enacted a law and they said, if you pray to any other god other than the king, or our gods over here, we're going to throw you in the lion's den. So Daniel, obeying God, the creator, you know, Elohim, rather than the king of Babylon, went out and prayed three times a day to his god, and they caught him doing that, and they threw him in the lion's den. His three cousins, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, were told that they had to pledge allegiance to the flag and sing the Star-Spangled Banner. Well, the equivalent thereof, you know, when the music plays, you know, you people stand up when the flag is displayed, and you gotta jump through the hoops here. Now, we do that here in the United States. You know, if you're out here in public and the flag goes by and the Star-Spangled Banner is being played, you know, you have to stand up and you have to cross your heart or salute, and we expect that of people. What would happen if you didn't do that? Oh, my God. That issue came up in 1943 with the Jehovah's Witnesses when they decided that they didn't want to pledge allegiance to the flag. And Americans, this is the middle of World War II, you know, when patriotism, you know, is very important. And, oh, my God, you know, they put these people in jail, prosecuted them. Now, fortunately, when it was all said and done, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed with the Jehovah's Witnesses and said, no, you don't have to stand up, cross your heart, sing the song, or pledge allegiance. But when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did that in front of Nebuchadnezzar, they threw him into the fiery furnace. We face that day after day. For instance, right now today, assuming that the census lady comes by and says, hey, Gordon, I want to count you, and I say, gee, no, I don't want you to count me because 2 Chronicles 24 prohibits that. It's against the law of God. You know, she's going to say, hey, it's the law. You have to do this. Now, most people, when they're faced with the highway patrolman with his billy club and his gun on his hip, you know, and he says, you have to do this or that or something else, you know, most people will acquiesce. They reason in their minds, well, God, you need to understand that, you know, I'm in great stress here, and so I've got to violate your law in order to comply with the law of Illinois or somebody else's law. Well, this is very common, and in case you're one of the people that says, you know, I'd kind of like to obey God and keep his commandments, we can do that, but it does take some effort. Now, listen to this. Back in 1690, the state of Massachusetts violated the Thou Shalt Not Steal law and the law that says in Leviticus 19:35 and 36 that you shall not have an unjust weight or balance. And that law is also repeated in Deuteronomy 25, verses 13 through 16, when they issued 7,000 pounds of printed bills of equal value with money. In 1691 and 1692, they did some more in the way of printed bills. They issued 30,000 pounds of printed bills, and then they made all of these bills of public credit current within this province in all payments equivalent to money, excepting specialties and contracts made before the publication of this new law. As a result, almost immediately all of the coin then in Massachusetts was exported to England, and new stock followed as fast as it came in from abroad. Trade and commerce declined. Hard times came upon the people. Well, in 1964, President Johnson introduced clad coin into circulation. By 1967, 3 years later, all of the silver coin in America disappeared from circulation, just exactly the same result that they got in Massachusetts from 1690 to 1692. During the 1970s, we went through a decade of recession, which ended in double-digit inflation in 1979, 80, and 81 that topped out at 21% interest rates. Gold hit $850 an ounce, silver $50. That's because that's a crime to do that. Now, in December of 1697, they passed legislation prohibiting the export of coin, silver, money, or bullion. In June of 1700, they established a committee to consider how to revive trade and to find out some suitable medium to supply the scarcity of money. Isn't that what Barack Obama and our government is doing today? Now, note that the word money in all colonial legislation was used exclusively for gold and silver coin, and the first issue of bills of credit of Massachusetts after it became a royal province for 10,000 pounds in value equaled the money in 1702. And they had economic decline, recession. They had unemployment. Paper money, boys and girls, is a crime. And this paper money has a result. It has a punishment. It has a climax. There's an end result that comes from it. Well, Great Britain, New Hampshire, Connecticut, New York, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, Maryland, South Carolina, Rhode Island, they all followed suit. And they did the same thing. They were out printing money, paper money, and they all had the same problems. They had a decline in commerce. They had unemployment. They had a debasing of the currency, a failure to make their payments. They went into default. They had the same kind of economic problems that we've got today, caused by the same things that causes it today. Banks, banking, and paper money. And so what's the solution to banks, banking, and paper money? Well, it's bigger banks, and more paper money. That's what they tell us. And, of course, there's a result that comes from that, and the next development of the colonial system of paper money was a partial repudiation and recognition of the evils of such a practice. The people of South Carolina had already recorded their sense of their mistake in the statute of the 11th of December of 1717, in which they said, "It is found by experience that the multiplicity of the bills of credit hath been the cause of the ruin of our trade and commerce, and has been the great evil of this province, and that it ought with all expedition to be remedied. On the 9th of January, 1739, the General Court of Massachusetts made this confession. They said, "The emission of great quantities of bills of public credit without certain provision for their redemption by lawful money in convenient time has already stripped us of all of our money and brought them into contempt of the great scandal of our government. For the remedy thereof, this province has fixed the value of their bills in lawful money and the time for their redemption in 1742. But that year went by, and relief had not been found. In 1744, James Allen, the preacher of the annual election sermon, addressed the governor from the pulpit thusly. He said, "Be the means of delivering us from the perplexing difficulties that we're involved in, by an unhappy medium uncertain as the wind and the land mourneth, and the cries of many are going up into the ears of the Lord of Sabbath." Unquote. Isn't that exactly the same predicament that we find ourselves in today? Why, it's precisely the problem. But today, our educators, who have taught and trained us to memorize rather than to think for ourselves, we have memorized these cliches and these quotations from John Maynard Keynes and from our politicians and from our news media, and they tell us these banks are too big to fail. Boys and girls, the colonies failed. And the United States of America is going to fail just like Greece, Italy, Portugal, Spain, Ireland. They're all going to fail. And that's because of this thing called sovereign debt, which is caused by paper money. But today, instead of saying to ourselves, "Hey, listen, what's causing this is paper money. Let's go back to gold and silver." No. They tell us the solution to the problem is more paper money. So in Europe, they just authorized a new $140 billion package to bail out Greece. It amounts to $940 billion, nearly a trillion, to bail out everybody else. It will, in fact, postpone the inevitable day of reckoning, but it isn't going to cure it or eliminate it. Now, when you and I, the little people out here in the real world, are faced with these kinds of perplexing legal problems, this is a legal problem. You and I need to get out of paper money. And if we don't get out of paper money, we're going to be buried with that paper money, and it's going to be wipe out for us. You are going to be financially wiped out with all of your paper assets. Now, let me give you a quick illustration. Congress is already taking testimony, and the proposal is to nationalize all of the retirement savings accounts of Americans. That means your IRAs and your Krogh plans are going to be nationalized so that the government can tap into, I think it's $9 trillion worth of money. They need liquidity. It's going to wipe you people out. Inflation, which now runs at 8%, is wiping you out because every year you're losing 8% of your purchasing power. So if you have $100,000 in your IRA right now, next May you're going to have $92,000 worth of purchasing power left. Isn't that just special? So a question arises, well, gee, what do we do about that? We need to take action, little guys like us. Close out your IRA, pay your penalties, and then let's do something more intelligent with our money, like put it into gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, oil, or eliminate our debt. You need to be debt-free. Now, does our government, do our preachers, does our news media tell us, boys and girls, we're in an economic catastrophe. Pay off all of your debts. No, they're telling you, go out and finance another house. Go out here and buy more. Consume more. Stimulate the economy. Go into debt. It's good for you. It's good for the economy, good for America. Well, boys and girls, if all this debt is so good for us, and we have $100 trillion of it now, wouldn't $200 trillion be twice as good? If our national debt's $12 trillion now, wouldn't $24 trillion be twice as good? If the Greeks are in debt $260 billion and can't service their debt, wouldn't $520 billion be twice as good? I tell you, boys and girls, our politicians, our news media, indeed our academia and our educational system have gone stark, raving mad. And they're drawing the entire nation into this vortex of insanity. A nation of people unable to think logically and rationally as to what caused this problem. This is not something new. It's happened to us time and time again in the past. And a nation that cannot learn from their mistakes is bound and determined to do it again. Aren't they? Now, I can't save America, but I can save myself. I don't have to go along with a multitude to do evil. I don't have to follow a mob of people into insanity. Well, there's a little more to the story. Great Britain enacted that no paper currency or bills of credit of any kind issued in any of the said colonies or plantations shall be a legal tender in payment of any private dues whatsoever within any of them. And Adam Smith wrote this, and he said, "No law," wrote Adam Smith, "could be more equitable." In his book, A Caveat Against Injustice, or An Inquiry into the Evil Consequences of a Fluctuating Medium of Exchange, Roger Sherman, the great statesman from Connecticut, wrote the following in 1752. He said, "Money ought to be something of certain value, money being that whereby other things are to be valued. And this I would lay down as a principle that cannot be denied, that a debtor ought not to pay any debts with less value than was contracted for, without the consent of or against the will of the creditor. If what is used as a medium of exchange is fluctuating in its value, it is no better than unjust weights and measures, both of which are condemned by the laws of God and man. And therefore, the largest and most universal custom could never make the use of such a medium either lawful or reasonable." Roger Sherman is credited with giving us that clause in Article 1, Section 10 of our Constitution that says no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. Now, we haven't followed our Constitution. We have followed Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, and the Republicans and Democrats. They have told us that paper money is good for us and that debt is the way to prosperity. Now take a look at our economic condition and ask yourself, have these blind leaders of the blind taken us into the ditch? Well, paper money in America from the beginning of the Seven Years' War to the Constitutional Convention of the United States brought us to the brink of economic collapse again. So, we went through it three times between 1690 and 1787. In 1783, when the continental currency collapsed, we bumped along on the bottom of a depression until 1787 at the Constitutional Convention, and we adopted new monetary policy. And in 1790, George Washington wrote a letter, and he said, "I'm amazed at how rapidly our economy and our economic fortunes have recovered in just 3 years by the use of hard money." Boys and girls, the economic crisis here in the United States could end in 36 months by use of hard money. Now, we're not going to go back to hard money as a nation, but you could go back to hard money tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. And as soon as you do, you're going to notice that there is a marked improvement in your economic fortunes. And in 36 months, you should have $100,000, at least $100,000 in value in gold and silver coin buried in a hole in the ground in 36 months if you go back to hard money. Now keep track of that statement that I just made, and then watch yourself 3 years from now and see, do you have that $100,000, or have you lost your house, your job, and are you on the brink, or are you over the precipice of bankruptcy? All of us have the choices to make. We have to make our choices at some point in time, and then there is a consequence that comes from the choice. Now, our government has made its choice. They have put us another $29 trillion in debt. They said we need more debt, and so they added $29 trillion. They bailed the banks out. They didn't bail out Main Street. They bailed out Wall Street. Well, there's a consequence that will come from that. There's a result that will result. I decided to step off to the side and watch you people and see how successful you are with this new debt strategy. I think I'll stick with thou shalt not steal, you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag, and hard money. I'll sit back and watch, and then we'll compare notes in 3 years, shall we? Now, the war for independence exhibited a new development of the system of credit by the reckless disregard of its bounds. Promises of money were scattered over the land alike by the states and by the United States until bills, to use the words of John Adams, became as plenty as oak leaves. The paper currency of the Congress was printed in such exorbitant amounts that wages and prices skyrocketed, forcing the legislature to enact harsh wage and price controls, and when these failed, moral-sounding laws reeking with piety and patriotism were enacted in an attempt to chain the people under penalty of law to the government's absurd money policy, such as this statute, which said, "If any person shall hereafter be so lost to all virtue and regard for his country as to refuse to accept its notes, such person shall be deemed an enemy of his country." Got that? That's almost like being branded a terrorist. Such person shall be deemed an enemy of his country. If you obey God, keep his commandments, and refuse to use Federal Reserve notes, paper money, mortgages, stocks, and bonds, you will be branded an enemy of your country. And when that happens, do you have an intelligent, logical defense? Do you know how to answer those charges and prevail? That's the real issue, and that's the real moral to the story of both the EPA and which one of these 12 men is a law school dropout. Hey, I'm out of time, boys and girls. We'll have to leave it right there and remind you that you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website. That's georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, our time's up. We got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody. And good night, friends.